Welcome to The Read-Along,
a mini book club for your ears.
I'm your host, Scott.
I'm your other host, Anita.
And join us on a journey through a good book,
one chapter at a time.
Do you like talking about movies? Do you like talking about mediocre movies? Do you like talking about how you could have fixed mediocre movies? Well, I certainly do, and you can listen to me, Scott C. Bourgeois, along with my co-hosts Greg Beaver and Liam Creswick, as we give our notes, and I have some notes. You can follow it now on your podcatcher of choice or support it by visiting patreon.com/ihavesomenotes. You know, sometimes it seems like we're sick a lot.
We have two small children. Of course we're sick a lot.
That's what I keep reminding myself, yeah. So last week, shortly after we recorded, G ended up falling sick. And he was like really sick for a day and then started gradually getting better he bounced back pretty well.
Yeah.
Like he's still kind of recovering, but he's on the very end of it.
Yeah. Our son is young and in school and
clearly brought something
sick.
Home, yeah. And then, so of course, by Friday, I was sick.
Yes.
And by Sunday,
our
daughter was sick. And now Anita's getting sick.
Yeah, and now it's Monday, and I'm feeling it. Yeah. It's coming.
So something's making its way through the house.
I do appreciate that it's making its way through our family one person at a time, though.
Yeah, rather than all of us at the same time.
Because being sick as a family sucks.
Yep. Yep.
Like, at the very least, you are going to be well enough to look after me when I get ill.
Yeah,
the same way I looked after you when you got ill.
It's nice to be spaced out a little bit.
A little bit.
Good news is COVID test came back negative.
Yes.
So it's not that. We figure it's some kind of flu, maybe, though.
Probably.
Because it sucks.
It sucks.
But if we sound a little scratchy or phlegmy on this particular recording, it's because, once again, something's making its way through our family.
TMI alert, there is a lot of snot.
That's where we're at.
Woo! Let's talk about a book.
Yeah. So I guess we'll start with a brief recap of our previous chapter, chapter 11.
That just seems right.
Where the undetectables were the first on the scene of a new murder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ben has been found dead in the basement of the Larricks. There's panic that ensues as people see a dead body. What?
I thought you were going to say Panic at the Disco. And it made me smile. Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry.
There is Panic at the Disco.
I don't know why that's so funny, but it is.
Mallory clears everybody out so that they can quickly canvass the crime scene before the police arrive. And they do, and so do some other unscrupulous people. And that leads us into chapter 12 of The Undetectables by Courtney Smith. So it's the next day.
Yes.
Everybody's had a night to like rest. Understandably, people need to grieve and decompress from what just happened.
Rest in quotation marks.
Yeah.
Right? I think Mallory got some sleep, but she needs medication to get through the morning because everything hurts.
But she needed medication to get through the night. She specifically says she took like some sleep aid.
Like emergency sleep medicine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's awoken by Cornelia, who's just like throwing open the curtains and being like, we need to get to work.
Everybody get up.
And one thing that's very clear through this chapter is that this is Cornelia coping.
Yes.
She needs to be focused on the case because otherwise she'll have time to focus on her feelings. And she does not want to do that right now.
Grief is strong. And sometimes you need to put it aside and you break down later.
Yeah. So she kind of like helps Mallory get up out of bed, casts a little helpful spell to like help with the pain a little bit.
Yeah, she puts a binding spell on her legs, like individually, right? So mm-hmm. Mallory can still use them, which I thought was a very sweet gesture.
Yeah.
Like she's trying to help her friend out, which I appreciate.
Yeah, and I also want to take a moment just to comment. Mallory thinks during this little opening part about how she finds it mind-boggling that people have suggested to her that regular exercise could help her mitigate her pain. And exercise hurts so much. And this just points back to something we discussed earlier in a previous episode, which is that she hasn't really tried it.
Nope.
Like, that's clear from her thought about that. She hasn't tried to help herself in that way because it seems too hard. Yes. She doesn't want to get over that initial hurdle.
Yes.
Which is the thing that's been holding her back from getting on with her life.
Look, the rut she has put herself in is deep.
Yes. And hopefully this will help push her out of it.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It would be delightful. But I don't want to retread something that we've already discussed ad nauseum. I thought it was an interesting thought that she had that pointed back to that.
It is a continuous thing.
Yeah. Cornelia gets Mallory up, gets Mallory out the bedroom, and Felix is already on the scene. Now, it's unclear if Felix spent the night or if they arrived in the morning just because they needed to be with friends to help them with their grief. But they're not in a good way.
Yeah, no, Felix is not okay.
No, Felix is very clearly blaming themselves for Ben's death. Unfairly. But,
agreed.
But because the Fae folk cannot lie, if it's a firmly held belief, he's telling the truth when he says, this is my fault.
Yeah, because they firmly believe that they are to blame. And I loved the exchange between the group of them when the undetectables originally start talking to Felix. I think it was Cornelia who said, you have to accept that we believe that you are not to blame.
Yeah.
All of these things can be true. We don't believe you are at fault. We accept that you do. So now the rest of Crown and Hemlock shows up as well.
Well, they don't so much show up as they are invited.
Yes, sorry.
Mallory, Diana, and Cornelia want to talk to them because they are key material witnesses to what happened. Hmm. And they know it'll be an easy interview because, again, fairies cannot lie.
It's true.
So they'll be able to get some honest answers out of them very quickly. They're not going to have to really like pull out the thumbscrews or anything.
Yeah. Which is very good for the case and also probably good for them as a group of friends, you know, to sort of be together moment of grief.
And to talk it out.
Yeah.
Crown and Hemlock are obviously all in grief and all shocked and all confused as to why this would happen to Ben. And it very quickly gets established that they don't know why someone would have targeted Ben directly. To the rest of the group, there's no obvious reason for Ben to have been specifically targeted, which leads the undetectable certainly to believe that Ben may have been a target of convenience.
Yes, a crime of opportunity.
Because he was alone in the basement briefly. And we also get the timeline that it couldn't have been more than maybe 10 minutes at most.
Yes.
Between 5 and 10, so 10 on the outside.
Right.
And we know the rough time because we know what time the band stopped. Because there's a specific noise curfew for the lyrics.
Yes.
Because the neighbors can still hear the music. It's quite loud.
It's quite loud.
So that puts his time of death around 11:30.
Yeah, within that little window there.
Yeah, which is around the time Custer is believed to have been killed.
Yes.
So that could be coincidence or it could be a correlation. We don't know.
Mallory has the same thought, although you are specific with a time.
Yeah.
Whereas she only groks to, it happened at night.
Yeah.
They think, right? They haven't proven Custer's time of death, but we know what it was.
The band agrees to get them the CCTV footage, which might come into play later. We don't know. So I want to mention it at the very least.
We'll put that on our own murder board.
And then go, because they have other grieving to do and family of Ben to go and visit as well.
Yes.
And that leaves the girls to have a minute to kind of like think.
Yeah.
And add stuff to their murder board.
Yeah, and add things to the murder board. We skipped over the part where Cornelia talks, I believe everyone is still there, when she talks about the prison.
Actually, now that I think about it, I believe the timeline of events is that she talks about it while Felix is there, but the band hasn't arrived yet.
Maybe that's where it was.
We can loop back.
Yeah. yes, let's. Cornelia, this feels important.
Yeah, Cornelia does elucidate on the prison thing, which seems like it might be an important clue.
Right.
Basically, so there was a time back in the day when a culture did have a prison here in Racton.
Yes.
The way that their prison worked is basically when you get put in jail, you get stripped of your powers. If you're magical, no longer magical.
Right.
Unclear if it's temporary or permanent.
Or just while you're there.
I think the context is that it's just while you're there.
Yeah.
But could be mistaken. Happy to be corrected on that down the road. And it was deemed kind of like a good thing for a long time. But there came a point back in the 70s, apparently, when the then Nightmare, the only non-Van Doren Nightmare, apparently, successfully lobbied to have it shut down because there was concerns about it being cruel and unsafe.
Well, yeah, because you would have to have, as a guard at a prison, you would have to have a ridiculous amount of protection.
Yep.
And if that failed at all, you were basically at the mercy of your prisoners.
Yeah, because you would also be stripped of your power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, unsafe, agreed.
Yeah. And so ultimately, the prison was shut down, and certainly Racton, and I think it's implied as well that much of the rest of a culture just kind of turned to exile.
Right.
As their form of punishment.
As punishment, yeah.
And social ostracization.
Which might be worse than you think, depending on a culture.
Depending on how a culture, the various cultures work together, yeah. And now the current Van Doren, Nightmare, has decided to kind of like change his tactic here. Because his mom apparently was lobbying to try to get the prison put back and failed.
And failed.
And so now he's like, well, okay, what if it's not like an occult jail? What if we just make it like an apparent jail? Because, I mean, their jails are full of people and we could make some money.
Well, full-profit jails.
Yeah.
Right?
For-profit jails. So that's kind of where he's going right now. And it's unclear if he's having a lot of success with it, but the implication is kind of...
Maybe?
At the very least, he's making a bid for the real estate for it.
Yeah.
Now, this ultimately leads to the girls talking about a rogues gallery of suspects.
A small but roguish gallery, yes.
Yeah, they've definitely kind of like lined up some initial suspects on their murder board at this point.
Yes.
Because there were certain people at the Larricks the night before who were suspicious.
Yes.
And of note.
Quite.
The first amongst those is Grey Quinn.
Yes.
The demon was there. He had an altercation, it seems, mm-hmm. with the management and was sticking around long enough to have been there when the murder happened.
Yes, because he was there talking to the Nightmare, who kept telling him to shut up.
Yeah. He's clearly in cahoots with the Nightmare, who is suspect number two.
Obviously, because he showed up at the nightclub and was talking to Grey Quinn.
He was Cornelia's suspect number one when they first took the case. But that's just her internal prejudice.
I was
going
to say, he's the suspect of everything,
yeah,
I think, in her head.
In her head, he's at the heart of every conspiracy. But Mallory has to admit the timing of his arrival and his attitude when he did arrive were very odd.
Yes.
And kind of off-putting.
Yes.
So something,
much like the first time they met him.
Yeah, so something was definitely up, and that puts him on the suspect board.
Yep.
Suspect number three catches Cornelia flat-footed.
Which it shouldn't.
And that's because Diana and Mallory are both like, so what about Beckett?
Yeah, so obviously Beckett. And she's like, what? He was just drunk. And they're like, no.
He was belligerent. He was a jerk. He purposefully offended the fairies, as far as we can tell. He disappeared at the time of the murder and showed back up afterwards.
And acted very surprised.
Exactly. So, like... That's suspicious.
Super suspicious.
And Mallory doesn't say it out loud, but she does admit Beckett wouldn't have been able to enact a magical murder without borrowing someone's magic. And she can't help but notice the hickey on Cornelia's neck.
Fingers crossed that it's only a hickey. It's the second time she's brought it up.
Yeah. So it's possible Beckett has been borrowing magic from Cornelia.
Maybe. I still think that Beckett is too obvious at this point.
Mm-hmm. And that leads us to the fourth suspect, the chief inspector.
Yes.
Mallory is reminded that the officers who arrived on scene spoke very disparagingly about O'Sullivan.
Yes.
And also commented, like, she's pretty jazzed about having a murder case. I wouldn't be surprised if she was killing people herself. We mentioned it last episode. And Mallory's like, that seems odd that they would be talking like that about her.
Right. It's very unprofessional.
So that leads me to wonder if there's something up there, if there's something worth investigating. So, Detective O'Sullivan, up on the suspect list.
Yeah.
And there's our current little rogues gallery.
Yep. We'll see what comes of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other good news is that the mass spectrometer has arrived.
This is so insane.
And they threw in a fingerprinting kit, or actually a full CSI kit. As like a bonus with it. And Mallory's like, oh God, I can't alienate Cornelia because we would not be able to continue funding this operation.
How does she just have the money for all of this?
And the reason why this comes up is because she needed some fingerprint testing for the note.
Yes, the stolen note.
Yes.
And the envelope.
That leads us to the envelope they found, which when they open seems to be addressed to them.
Well, that's Mallory's theory, right? After they've done the decode, right? Because they needed to to uncode, as you will. There's a line in there about, like, it's the very first line.
Second line, actually.
Second line, sorry.
More brownie points to you, for I have noticed your efforts and am sorry to bear message. Your time will end. You have until I strike at midnight, Samhain. These executions are just. You will all exceed when you understand. Courage is for those obediently following orders. Blair's bell protects none. More will succumb.
Right.
So a promise for more murders, a timeline of events, a matching of wits with capable opponents.
Maybe.
I did look into Blair's bell. I couldn't find anything, so not certain what that's about.
I don't know. It's clearly then in-universe lore that we will have to learn about.
Indeed.
Yeah. So Mallory thinks that those opening lines are directed specifically at them.
Yeah.
Right? I'm not entirely sold on it. I agree it's likely, but it's not 100%. Because why would it have been delivered on Ben, given there was a chance that the letter might not have gotten through that way?
Well, here's how I'm going to counter that.
Okay.
If Ben wasn't a random attack, as we thought, if he was a victim of convenience, yes, but a victim known to the undetectables, who were just upstairs.
Oh, I see where you're going. Okay.
Then you might reasonably leave a note right there.
Yes. Okay. Gotcha. Meaning Ben was on purpose because he was their friend.
Or
he was the closest friend that the killer could kill.
Now, that's one way of looking at it. I will grant it's possible that it could have been anyone found alone at the Larricks that night.
Yeah. And our killer was just assuming that the undetectables would be there.
Would be first on the scene.
Knowing that they were on the scene. So they would have had to have been in the know.
So it's possible that it was Ben specifically because he was known to them. It's possible that it was a victim of convenience in a location they were at.
Yeah.
But it also means the killer knew they were there.
Well, and again, that is assuming that this letter is in fact addressed to them.
And not addressed to O'Sullivan.
Right? You know what I mean?
Which is possible.
There are no names on that note.
No.
It could have been misinterpreted.
It's true.
It's very prose-ish, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And with that, Theodore bursts into the room and announces he's ready to solve a murder. And that's pretty much where the chapter ends.
Adore Theodore.
Yeah. Which might just mean that he's ready to drop like another little clue nugget on them to help point the investigation, which is all he's really been doing so far.
That's okay.
But he's clearly thinking about the case. So we had discussed briefly before, because I wanted to run it down with Anita. We're recording a little later than normal, and I wanted to remind myself what the timeline of events was. So we were chatting just a little bit before we recorded. And that led me to a totally unsubstantiated and incredibly harebrained theory.
But I liked it. I thought it was very smart.
And Nita is insisting that I bring it up.
Yes, please.
Which is, like, we've already previously discussed that the nature of the murders is very placid. It's very peaceful.
Yes.
It's violent, but it's not perceived as violent by the victims.
Right.
And that might indicate that the killer is doing it as an act of mercy or under a feeling of obligation. And this note seems to kind of bear fruit to that.
A little bit.
That this is a person who's doing what they think is right. When we also take into account that we've just been dropped the bombshell that there are no prisons for at least the occult in Racton, and that the best they get, no matter what their crime, is a little slap on the wrist and told to go away, could this be a vigilante?
See, I like that theory.
Could this be someone who's specifically targeting people who have done a crime, but have not been punished?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in Racton. Maybe they've come to Racton after having done a crime. Maybe they've done a crime and they don't even realize it, because that would point back to Beckett inadvertently offending the fairies.
Right.
If it was inadvertent. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt for this theory, that it's possible that Ben might have committed a crime and not even know it.
Right? Accidentally offended someone.
Or if he did commit a crime and knew it, nobody knew to ask him about it, so he never had to lie about it. We'd know nothing about Custer.
Especially not in any of those regards.
Yeah,
right?
he was a shut-in. He could have been on the run from the law. We don't know. So there's scant evidence to support this idea, but I'm just floating it as a possibility that this could be someone enacting a twisted sense of justice. Now, this doesn't tie in necessarily to the sigils that are being carved on the bodies. This doesn't necessarily explain why it's all being tied into Samhain. That might come later. I don't know. But this is my irresponsible speculation at the
moment. Well, and then I sort of expanded on your irresponsible speculation and sort of added to it, to tie it into Samhain, what if we are in fact dealing with a zealot, right? You could point to evidence in the note for that too, right? Yep. Those who are following orders. Maybe these are religious, maybe it's religious vigilantism. Is that a thing? It could be.
Yeah. Hard to say. Impossible to tell at this point. and almost certainly wrong.
Oh, very irresponsible of us.
But we will have to wait and see. Perhaps finding out more as we move into chapter 13 of our novel, which you'll want to read up on in time for next week. In the meantime, of course, as always, you can give us a little rating and a review on your podcatcher of choice.
Because we love you and appreciate you.
It's true. You can also reach out to us via social media.
Yes, we are on X. We are on Facebook. We are on Instagram. We are on Goodreads. And we are on Blue Sky. And we are at the read-along on most of those.
Correct. You can also send us an email.
Absolutely. We would love an email. We are thereadalong@gmail.com.
And with that said, as always, we love you very much, and we'll see you next time.
Love you too. Bye.
Thank you for joining us on The Read-Along with your hosts, Anita and Scott Bourgeois. All Read-Along music is by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Cover art is by Aaron Beaver. Be sure to join us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at The Read-Along, and check out our group on Goodreads.com.